Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just 15 bucks a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Afua Hirsch is coming. Lovely Afua.
Have you met Afua?
Yeah, loads of times.
See, I've not actually ever met her.
You and Afua have never met?
No.
I didn't realise that. Oh, she's fantastic. She's a brilliant, brilliant woman and lovely and funny and interesting. And she's bringing her sister with her. And I don't know if it's her little sister or her big sister, Amma. So I'm really interested and excited to meet her sister.
I feel like me, Mum and Afua are very much like have similar intentions of the kind of TV we're trying to make.
Yeah.
The kind of voices that we want in more mainstream places. I don't know, we just watched a bit of the brilliant BBC series that she did, Africa Rising. I hadn't actually seen it. I wanted to, but I missed it.
Fantastic.
We just watched a bit. It was made so beautifully, and I really want to talk to her about the experience of making that, mirroring our experience making our show for the BBC in the Caribbean. But I felt really proud watching her on that. She did a really beautiful job.
Oh, she looks amazing.
And she looks banging. Oh, my God.
The whole show, actually, is stunningly beautiful. I don't know who shot it. I don't know who directed it, but seriously.
We need to know.
Like, seriously, it's absolutely stunning.
For people who don't know Afua, how do we describe her? How would you describe her?
Afua is a writer.
Interestingly, I was going to ask her how she describes herself when it comes to the things she does, because I don't know whether the broadcaster would be anywhere near the top.
No, she's a social commentator.
Yes.
And she's a writer.
Journalist.
And a thinker.
A thinker.
A thought person.
She's a thought person.
She's a thought person. I love a thought person.
She's got, like, you know, she's got thoughts.
She's got thoughts and she's a person.
Stop barking like a crazy dog.
It's Afua Hirsch, okay? She's quite an elegant lady. So
if you could just shut up, Scout, for once in your life.
Yeah.
But Afua likes dogs, I'm discovered.
Yes,
we've established.
Afua and Amma.
I know.
Hi, guys.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you two?
Glory on our top step.
How are you, Scout?
So glad to have you guys here.
You've got a lot to say.
Nobody's
going to
open.
Oh.
Here we go, you're in there.
Yeah, go in there.
Come
into our home.
Oh, hello. So good to have you
this
here.
Such a treat.
Oh, we're so thrilled that you've come. Welcome to the table.
Welcome to our home.
Afua, thank you so much for coming. I'm very thrilled that you're here. So shall I tell you what we have on the plate? Turnip puree that's made with oat milk, actually, just to stop it being too heavy, but it really brings out the... Turnips are really funny because they're bitter. People tend to avoid them. There's like a kind of funny thing about, you know, awful boiled turnips. If you can
think English,
them.
Bad English race.
Yeah, bad school moments in your life. But you make a turnip puree, it's a thing of beauty. So we've made a creamy turnip puree, leek tops sautéed with green seasoning, which is like garlic and chilies, and lots of herbs and spring onions. And spinach, so that's just sautéed off. Then we've got a lamb fillet that's got pil biber, which is like a Turkish chili, and just salt and pepper, and we seared that off in the pan with loads and loads of butter and oregano and thyme and garlic.
It was a great moment.
And
then I made a
lamb broth last night, so we finished it with a lamb broth and green seasoning and just let it rest. And then we've got crispy leeks on the top and some parsley, crispy fried parsley, and a little bit of chive and parsley oil.
Are these like wheat berries or
giant couscous? Oh, and frigola. It's frigola. which is like a, it's like a pasta, but it acts more like a grain.
Wow.
It's like a Sicilian pasta. And then here in this teapot is the lamb broth. So shall I show you?
Just so take pretty
it.
As
We're
well.
Very big fans of sort of pouring gravy or the sauce or the little, broth.
You're so fancy. Oh, yeah. So this is how you guys eat every day?
Absolutely, every single day.
Family.
But are you both in Wimbledon then? Do you, because that's where you grew up, and then have you both migrated back, as it were?
Wow. Pretty much. I'm on the edges.
I've tried really hard to get away from Wimbledon. It might, like, really hard. It just never worked.
Pulled you back.
Sucked me out. And our grandmother, who's 90, about to be 94,
wow,
lives in Wimbledon. We both in Wimbledon. Our parents are there. It's my village.
Everybody's
just
there.
Had to surrender to it.
Absolutely. That's your end.
It is my end.
Because there's nothing worse than not having your people near you.
Do you know what? It was really embarrassing growing up. Like, when you used to meet people, like, raving and stuff, they'd be like, so, where are you from? Where are you from? And you'd be like, south. And you'd be like, which part south? And you'd be like, southwest. And they'd be like, what, Brixton? And you'd be like,
Wimbledon.
And then they'd be like, that's not South London. I'd be like, it is, technically.
Were there other black families around Wimbledon when you guys were growing up?
There was one.
Because I grew up in West London, which was just ridiculously diverse and multicultural and creative. And
the opposite.
Beautifully.
Yeah,
so.
the opposite, exactly. And I really took it for granted, but I really wanted to live somewhere like Wimbledon.
Did you?
Yes.
Why? Oh my God.
In response to the kind of chaotic, crazy beauty, I was like, I think we need more order. And
in response to me being her mother.
Like, really. I really want a really conventional.
Yes, yeah, suburban home. So when they moved here, I was like, we're finally moved. To the suburbs. I'm so pleased.
She used to, like, show me pictures of what she wanted me to really wear. Do you know what
really?
I mean? Like, we're twin sets. I'm like, that's not going to happen.
Where was this coming? Was this friends' parents that you...
No, actually, no. I just wanted the opposite. And I was, like, deeply living in kind of denial of being black at all, really. And funky. I didn't want to be those things. I wanted to be, like, straight and blonde and...
I completely relate to that, but it surprises me in West London because I really envied, growing up in Wimbledon, people who lived in West London because it seemed like it was so normal to be black or mixed race. It was just like, it wasn't even diversity. It was just everyone lived together. There was so much like cultural expression. So I was seeking that because I found Wimbledon very claustrophobic and very white, like the tyranny of kind of whiteness.
So how do you both feel about bringing up your children there now?
That's a great question.
It is. I'm in the more diverse end of the borough, let's say.
That is true.
So I have a bit more street cred with that. So, like, the school my children go at is actually really diverse.
Mm.
So technically we're not Wimbledon, but we're just about cling on to the postcode.
Okay, how old are your children?
7, 5, and 2.
So your dad's British, your mum's Ghanaian, and I read the best story, I loved it so much, where you were talking about having... your British aunt, so were they maybe your dad's sisters?
Mm-hmm.
And they came to Ghana.
Oh, yeah.
And you were somewhat worried about them because you were thinking, oh, God, they were
How
very...
How are they going to cope?
Yeah, travelling around.
They don't know. They've never been to an African country before. You know, they're kind of very British.
They wanted to explore.
They definitely had an adventurous spirit. But I was a little... Because like our Hirsch family, they're kind of lefties, you know. Our grandfather was like definitely a socialist, his whole life, committed socialist his whole life. So... Of course, like when they came to Ghana, I knew they weren't going to like want to go to 5-star hotels. They were want
to
go like get public transport.
To feel like they're in
they
Ghana.
They were going to want to be ground level because that's what that's generally how they are, which is cool.
Yeah.
But I feel like if it's your first time in an African country, it's a different level.
I've definitely.
Well, they might not know what to expect.
But they went in, they had
the full experience.
They did things that I, having lived in Ghana for years, would never have dreamed of doing. Like they took like public transport on like a 7-hour journey. And they were like, yeah, it was great. There were chickens next to us. And like, go.
We've done that.
What, on a trot-trot to like Axim?
Yeah.
No.
What's a trot-trot?
A trot-trot is like a like minibus. It's like they don't have like they don't really have state organized public transport. So just these entrepreneurs will have these minivans.
Okay. It's like those.
It's like in Kenya.
Matatus. Yeah.
Like every African country has some version of this. Like, and you know, they may or may not have brakes.
Mm-hmm.
They may or may not have doors. You know, like you kind of roll the dice.
It's real. It's real.
It really is. Yeah. We spent a summer in Ghana together. In like 2006, we both had jobs in Ghana And we lived together and we commuted like with those trotters to work.
Which was hilarious.
That was a whole experience.
My God, that's such a laugh.
It was hilarious. And we were there with our grandmother who wouldn't let us out after about 6 p.m.
But anyway, our aunties were hardcore and they had the time of their lives. And I think the reason I was writing about it was because they said, because they were like around, I guess in their early 50s then, maybe mid-50s. And they were saying like they feel so invisible in Britain.
Mm. Right.
And they didn't even realise how invisible they feel until they went to Ghana, whereas 50-something-year-old white women on a trotro, you are not invisible. No.
But yeah, well, quite. The more I was reading, it was sort of opened me up to that kind of the complete difference in approach to ageing, which is a celebration and something to be proud of to age in Africa. But in Britain, it's something to be ashamed of, something to halt, something to stop as women. Black women, no, it doesn't matter. Just I think as women, I think more than men, let's be honest.
I think everybody feels it, but I think women feel it most. You know, like men are called things like silver fox.
Yeah.
And women are called things
spinster.
Like... she's looking at, yeah. Like cat lady.
Lots of men are considered more attractive as they get older.
As they get older, and women, it's...
it creates this, like, self-loathing. Like, everyone's going to get older. It's the most inevitable thing.
Right, if you're lucky.
You've entered your 40s. Are you still in your
30s? Yeah, still in my 30s.
Right, so I'm 39 and I'm 40 this year.
Oh.
And it's been,
how do you
like...
feel?
Fucking terrified.
Oh, you're terrified?
Yeah. What's up?
Are you really?
I feel like, shall I be really honest, I feel like on April 26th, the day after my birthday, all of my desirability, my... what's the right
visibility?
Word? Visibility, yeah. My desirability and my visibility will go... and everything I have to say will become obsolete.
Do you... that's your fear, or that's what you...
that's my fear. Like, but it's so illogical, because it's not like I feel like it might happen this year or next year. It's like on April 26th.
But I would actually say that is... This probably doesn't sound comforting, but it hopefully will be. That is a rational fear, not because that's going to happen. Like, it's not true, but because, like, you've been brainwashed from birth by a society that tells you that.
Mm.
Like, constantly sells us images of younger women as attractive, that kind of like disappears older women, and then now sells us multiple ways we can make ourselves artificially look younger.
Yeah,
yeah.
And presents that as the ideal. I'm living in LA at the moment, and it's next level.
No, but is it next level? Because I'm freaked out by surgery in this country right now. I feel like it's
worse, and it's got worse because now everyone's on Ozempic in LA.
Oh yeah.
And so it's this weight loss drug that's like changed.
And it's meant to be for
diabetes. But there's a few of them that now, like, everybody's on them. Like, everybody's become extremely thin.
It's injections.
The first place you lose fat is in your face, right?
Yeah.
So now everyone's looking old. So now the fillers and the Botox have gone to like another level to compensate for all the Ozempic. I went to this party's premiere in LA, and I was like, everybody is stick thin, and their face is like pumped. But it was just, it was like a dystopian.
It does make you feel like you're in a crazy,
it really
mad
did.
World.
It did. I was like this
circus.
Is not normal. And I think, like, I understand why people do that, because especially in a city where like so much of your career success is dependent on looking attractive or being seen as attractive, it's like your currency
and youthful, which is equated to youth.
It makes sense. I get it. I'm not trying to judge people, but I think I always criticizing the root cause of why people feel pressured to do things. It's not necessarily a choice.
Yeah.
It's like your financial viability depends on doing it, and so like for you feeling that way about turning 40, I get it, because it is scary, because you've been told that like you're beautiful and desirable and interesting and precious because you're young.
Sometimes. And
then when you're older, you're none of those things.
Yes, and I think I wanted to ask, actually, before I continue, what do you do? Are you in academia?
So I'm a child psychologist.
Okay.
And I was going to say, when you said that, actually, to what extent do you think feeling like that's so linked to the industry you're in? Because in my field, I actually find it really helpful to be getting older, because I have more credibility, I'm seen as more experienced.
Interesting.
I've had situations where a head teacher threw me out of a staff room of a school I was working in, thinking I was one of the excluded kids from the school. When I'd been a commissioned psychologist for that school for like 6 years. It was a pupil referral unit. And because I looked young, I don't have the credibility. So actually for me, work-wise, it's quite helpful that I'm aging and I've now got children and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Because it adds credibility to what I do. But I get in the industry you're all in.
Yeah.
No,
it's completely
different.
I
feel
different
the
pressures.
Same way in some ways, because I feel the older I've got, the more credibility I've got, because I'm more confident.
Yeah.
And I feel more like I have the right to be in the room, at the table, run the table. It's my table. Do you know what I mean? It's all of that stuff. And that has come with age. I certainly didn't feel this way 30 years ago.
And my mum's career actually went to this stratospheric place in her 50s. Mm. For me, it's like, look at the lesson. But it's just, as you said, it's so ingrained that it's like, actually, you've got to kind of cut an old pattern in your own thoughts. Because wouldn't it be funny if our 40s and 50s and 60s were the most powerful time in our lives?
Oh, very convenient.
Very convenient to tell us that this is where it ends, when actually this is probably
where it ends. They are the most powerful times in your life. I'm telling you, it's all to come, people.
I think because you've been like conditioned with this idea, I think you need a strategy for coping with those feelings. Yeah. And so my strategy was writing this book and leaning into cultures where you get celebrated for aging, which are basically all cultures except Northern and Western Europe, basically.
Yes.
And so like in our Ghanaian heritage, you're basically a nobody until you've hit like what we would call middle age. And you're like a proper VIP. The older you get, you know, you are the center of attention. People congregate around you. You are held up. And you're judged on your contribution to your community, what you've survived, the wisdom. You're like a repository of your culture's stories and experience. Wow. Like you're really, and I've, you know, you kind of grow up with that, even if you can't articulate it. And I suddenly realized, like, if I have a choice, I could embrace these Western ideas that make me feel bad about myself, or I could embrace these like African ideas that make me feel good about myself. It's a bit of a no-brainer, like I'm choosing. Yeah. But you have to be very deliberate about it, because you're still living in a society that is kind of feeding you.
Yeah, so I think it's a daily choice.
Yeah, I agree.
Like each day,
hourly,
you wake up and your mind's going, which way are you going to go?
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Your book, Decolonizing My Body, I really wanted to talk about that. I really wanted to talk about the process of what was your intent with writing it, and what did you mean for yourself by decolonizing your
body? When I started thinking about this book, I was your exact age, about to turn 40, feeling exactly like you, like it was such a big deal, which in hindsight, nothing changed, obviously, overnight. But like we've all been programmed to think it's a... And I think, you know, also building on what you said, it was more than just like, I'm going to look less attractive and be less desirable. It's almost like my identity. Like my identity was as like a young person.
Yes. Yeah.
I was like that young woman. I was doing all these things. I just felt really, I kind of like embraced that. And suddenly it's like, I'm not young anymore.
That's it.
I don't know who I am then.
It's the mental
shift. And you enjoy that I'm a young person because everyone rewards you for that. It was really painful to realize like I'm not that person anymore, because I really in theory believe in self-love and wellness and also not buying into societal ideas, like creating my own ideology. But in practice I was like, how am I going to do that?
Because they're separate things, right? It's like what your head understands and what your heart
exactly
feels are two different things.
It's all good
things,
in theory.
Is that what you mean me?
And so a lot of women I knew were starting to, and I think being in TV and the media as well is really hard. A lot of women I knew starting to like get little fillers and nips and tucks and stuff. And again, no judgment, some look amazing. But I was like, I felt like if I wasn't going to go down that route, I was going to need a reason not to.
Yeah.
Because otherwise it just happens. And I just was thinking about, like I was saying, my Ghanaian heritage. And I was thinking, in my ancestral culture, women used to mark their bodies like scarification, tattooing. It was one of the ways you celebrated aging and the status and the wisdom you developed.
Connected to aging.
Yeah, so there were all these tattoos that marked like the rites of passage, the stages of life. Mm. And I was kind of brought up to think that was kind of backward, like, you know, something we left behind when we became civilized and Christian.
So called, yeah.
Right, and I realized that's a really, you know, I do a lot of work on like colonization and racism, and I was like, how have I still got these basic racist ideas about my own culture? And then I thought, I think it's totally normal to like get operated on to look young, but to have a very natural ancestral ritual of marking my body to feel good about who I actually am
and where my life is actually,
and where my life actually is, I think that's backward.
Like, this
is
hand?
Crazy. So that's why I got my hand tattooed.
Oh my God.
I was like, this is what I'm going to choose.
Were you
I'm
there
gonna...
when she did it?
No.
Oh, okay. It's so beautiful. You didn't have like family going,
okay. No, I went on my own.
It looks like lace.
Yeah. Oh, we were all like, but it's henna, right?
They were all, I was like, so I'm going to get this tattoo, blah, blah, blah. And then they also were on, they were like, but it comes off, right?
They're like, six right. weeks, 8 weeks? How long are we talking?
Let me see it. Oh my goodness, it's beautiful.
So the artist who did it, who's called Emmy Lindholm, she's amazing. You can find her on Instagram. Her Insta is Emmy_Lat_Grizzly. Her whole specialism is ancestral indigenous tattoo cultures for women and like restoring them. And she's Mauritian Chinese heritage, found it very healing in her own life when she started doing these like ritual tattoos. And so now she does it for other women and it's kind of taken off.
Wow.
And I think so many of us are on that journey of just trying to work out like our identity, our connection to ancestry, navigating aging, our bodies as women.
It's interesting because one of the other things is that I don't have children and I do want to have children. So I'm sort of obsessively reading these wonderful stories of like Chloe Savigny meeting her husband at 45 and having a baby at 46. I was like, okay. Because actually the way my life has gone, it makes a lot of sense for me to become a mother later because my life has been about my career most since 15. And I think that's also why I'm scared of aging because everyone's like, you're doing this, you're on telly, you're good at it and you're only 15. And I sort of kept that till you're only 30, you're only 32.
You're so young.
Yeah, you're so young for what you're doing. I remember even by the time I was 21, people weren't as impressed and I was like, okay, I'm going to have to start saying I'm 19. Like, I need
your case is really
out.
Extreme because you were so young when you became famous and successful in your career.
Yeah, so it's a real like attachment to that glory and validation. But you two both have kids. So what I say to all my friends with kids, which is about 85% now, it's funny how you can even be a mother of children and still be like, oh God, I can't believe I have to turn 40. It's like, but surely you feel so grown being a mum.
I'm going to defer to Emma because she's the actual grown-up in this situation.
And I'm also kind of asking Emma.
She's an actual grown-up with like an actual family, three children, lovely home, schedules, everything
planned. How old are you, Emma?
I'm 38.
38 so and I'm, 3 kids under 10.
Yeah, so I had them at 30, 32, 35. And I think maybe that is why I'm not so worried about aging because having children was a big thing for me. But because I've done that, I feel fine about aging because I don't feel... I kind of have that big thing I've accomplished that I wanted to.
Also because what you've been through is so crazy that like what else is going to phase you?
Life is just so mad for me at the moment.
Having three boys
who are bouncing off the walls.
Because you don't just have a baby. Yeah, you're not raising
two children. That was what the shock was.
We grew up the two of us girls as well.
Yeah,
we didn't grow up
with
boys.
It's a shock every day for me. The fact
so just the reality of boys is like completely new.
Totally like willies.
I'm always playing my or texting my sister like, hey, I'm like, I'm in the park again. I'm messy and I'm in goal this time. And it's raining. And
I'm in the park and this time I'm in goal.
My sister's always like, oh, we have pajama days until midday on a weekend. And I'm just like, I've already done swimming.
Boys don't, they don't do that?
Right.
Lying around, let's watch Little Women
in the park.
Interesting,
mum.
Isn't that interesting? Because there weren't really boys, just loads of us girls.
We were the same. It's constantly fascinating.
I feel a bit guilty. Like, me and my daughter... Like when we go on holiday, we basically lie until 12, have like breakfast in bed,
get manicure.
I go and have like a cocktail. She has a mocktail. Yeah, get a mani pedi.
It's different. No, it's great. I
Isn't that
it.
Interesting
it's great
though?
Fun.
Because you think about societal norms and where does that come from? Like, you know, I don't believe that men and women or boys and girls have ascribed behaviour at birth. It's like you do what you do and your personality and your character drives that. But then when you talk about that, I'm just like, my God, that sounds exhausting.
I didn't think so until I had sons.
I found my views about gender being a construct severely tested. Severely.
You're like, can everyone stop being quite so stereotypical?
My daughter, she would sit around.
Yeah. Like she would sit colouring all day.
The first toy I ever got my daughter was a tool bench.
Right.
She was not interested in the tool bench. She wanted dolls, colouring, puzzles. She just sit there all day just doing these little things. Amma's boys, who are the best little boys ever. They are so gorgeous. But you said they would be sprinting.
Oh, yeah.
They just sprint ever. They don't walk. They sprint.
It's energy.
They bite. And they kick things. Yeah. They climb things.
Yeah. They throw things. I tried to do the whole non-gendered toys. Like, we have a little toy buggy and a little brown baby, which they have all loved. And my two-year-old currently is obsessed with. He's called Handspray.
What, the baby?
The baby.
Handspray.
Handspray. Lockdown children. Just bear with it.
Not the child, the toy.
No, sorry. Yeah, my child's not called Handspray, the doll. My little one comes zooming down the road. But you know how with the doll, and we thought it'd be a nice nurturing non-gender toy for them to have. Literally, it's like Formula One. They like drive it up the walls. They lob Handspray across. They play basketball with Handspray, lobbing him in the basketball.
Mind you, I was quite violent with my doll. I used to take their heads off.
Emma, you tried.
I tried. Emma, I tried my best psychological interventions.
And I mean, you're a child psychologist.
I know. So that's what I'm saying.
So both sisters being very challenged by, not challenged, but like, maybe ideas about motherhood and children.
I thought it was all conditioning.
Mm, yeah.
And like, our children were all born with specific personalities intact.
Mm.
I would say.
Mine definitely have a strong masculine energy, I'd say.
People say by seven you are you, you know? I think it's quite interesting watching the ego come in, because my cousin Phoebe has two kids, a boy and a girl. And at about five, I was like, why are they being such little assholes? And she was like, because their ego is becoming apparent. And I thought, oh my God, the development of an ego. How do we stop it right now?
Nikita takes it really personally. I'm like, Nikita, she's seven. You can't just, she's just seven.
Why is she? It's like, because she's seven. That's what's seven. No, I just feel like people are kind of who they are, very young. I know I was.
Yeah, you were. You were very similar when you were five to how you are now. She used to kind of come in the room and kind of go, everybody stop and look at me.
No, not as simple as that. More nuanced, surely.
Not really. Okay. Like, you know, everybody stop and look at me and James Brown, dancing to James Brown.
You had a real academic life, Afua. I didn't even know you also trained as a barrister.
Mm.
Wow.
That's what I spent my 20s doing. Mm. I actually, after everything we said about aging, I would not go back
that age
to being in my 20s.
No, not 20s.
If you paid me. I found my 20s really stressful. I was really purposeful. Like, I had a really strong kind of sense of mission. I wanted to become this barrister. I wanted to practice human rights law. I really cared about it. I was really devoted to it. I worked really hard. But the funny thing about my 20s, I basically spent it at a desk. The whole thing, like, it was
no parties.
The thing is, I'd kind of got that out of my system in my teens.
She peaked early with that.
I peaked early. So it was fine. And it's one of those things. I'm actually proud of what I did, because I really wanted to be a human rights barrister. I got into the chambers that I really wanted to be at. It's called Doughty Street. It's Amal Clooney's chambers. It's like very big international human rights cases.
How do you get into the chambers?
So I didn't do law at university, so I had to convert to law, which is a year. Then I had to do bar school, which is another year. Then you have to do pupillage, which is like an apprenticeship in chambers. Yeah. And those are really difficult to get. And I did that at Doughty Street. And then I got there and I was called to the bar and qualified. And then I looked around and I realized... I've been so focused on this vision, and now I'm here in my, like, the dream place.
Yeah, you're gonna do it.
It's not me.
Oh, no. But what does that feel like after all that work?
Well, I'm really proud now of my younger self having the courage and self-knowledge to walk away, because you get so much status and societal approval. You know, like, our mum was so proud. That was her dream. And I feel like I was honest enough with myself to be able to say, I will forego all of that approval. I didn't even have a plan B at the time. I was like, I know this isn't who I am. And I also know I can't really work out what I'm meant to do while I'm here, because it's taking up all my headspace. So I think it was quite brave of me to just leave. Other people in my life didn't necessarily share that.
How was mum? Feel about it, Amma?
I could see she wasn't herself. Like, you were. I remember kind of meeting you I think it was on a birthday, and there was that. We went to a Donnell Jones and Avant concert in Brixton.
Oh my God, what?
And it was amazing. We bumped into Avant in the toilets, who was chatting us up. And then after the concert, it was literally amazing. You had to go back to work, and it was things like that, and like working literally constantly, and you were always getting ill, and so I was quite surprised, and I like a structure and a plan, so it was a bit unsettling.
And it was hard for me to accept that this thing I'd basically sacrificed like all these years doing wasn't what I wanted, but I'm so grateful in hindsight because it opened the path for all the things I really now realize I was meant
those
to do.
Those moments are really important, I think, in your life when your inner voice is going, stop, turn around, turn left, turn right. That, you know, because I think it's quite easy to ignore that voice, but it makes me feel a bit like nauseated.
What, hearing that
voice? If I ignore that voice.
Yeah, but Oprah says it's a whisper, it's a whisper, it's a whisper. And until you hear it, if you don't hear it, then it's a punch in the face. If you don't listen, suddenly something happens. And you're like, what am I doing here? So it's good you heard the whisper.
Makita has two goddesses. One is Oprah, the other is Barbara Streisand. Yesenia.
So they may come up quite a lot.
Oprah,
we should start doing an Oprah Barbara warning. Barbara Streisand quote coming up. But I really do know what you mean by it. It's like, it's fucking terrifying to leave something. And to just look for something.
And especially when you've been focused on it and that's your plan. And then you realise that if you walk away from that, you're going to have to start all over again with working out what you see.
Especially it took so long to get there as well. It's not like it was a year working and then you get it. It's like 6 years or something.
But of course, now I realise like it led to all the next things.
Yes.
So it was part of my path. So I don't regret it at all.
But it's also a very you thing to do because you always rebel. You always go against the grain. Really? You always challenge the parents. So
you're
very good at doing that.
Not for the sake of rebellion, though. No. But when I do something, if I rebel, it's for a reason.
Tell me about these partying days in your teens.
Oh God, I'll tell you about that.
I think I'll just take it straight to Emma. What is this, in Wimbledon, or are you taking it to Brixton?
Central West End. She took it to the West End.
In Venice, there was a productive point. So I started writing for The Voice when I was 14.
Oh, wow.
14?
I know. I did just like one day of take your daughters to work day. My cousin was already a journalist there. She's 10 years older. And I literally, like, I found my calling. I loved it. And there were two things about it I loved. I realized I loved journalism. Like, I was really curious. I loved to write. I loved to meet people. But on a deeper level, I was growing up in Wimbledon, and then I went into The Voice, and it was like everyone was black.
Right.
Not only was everyone black, but this was like an organization they had founded, they ran. The editor, the photographer, the receptionist, everyone was black. And it was such a nurturing environment for me. Mm. They were like, how can we build you? It was so, like, I still have so much love for everybody I work with there. And amazing. And you know, I realized actually a lot of the black journalists who now you see on the biggest news platforms started there.
Started at The Voice.
Because we couldn't get into the mainstream. No one would hire you, even if you were straight out of Oxbridge at that point. But The Voice would give you a job. And then once you'd built your reporting or writing track record, then you could start getting into more mainstream titles. But The Voice was such an important like incubator of black talent.
Mm.
And for me, it was really life-changing. So
for anyone that doesn't know, The Voice was a black run. The Voice is still with us.
It's the oldest black newspaper in Britain.
Ah. Oh.
It's still like an important voice for the black community.
Like so many.
Still based in Brixton.
That's amazing.
And it was really life-changing for me. And I did start out writing about issues facing young black people. But then there was this one seminal moment that I'll never forget where basically I was in the newsroom. I used to go after school. And this was 1997.
Mm.
And someone was like, ugh, this R&B singer from America called Usher's here. Nobody can be bothered to go. I was like,
oh.
I've got a picture of Usher, me 16, Usher 18,
oh my
him kissing me. I need to take that picture out.
Wait a minute. Get it.
Wasn't it When You Make Me Wanna came out?
You Make Me Wanna had just come out. And I interviewed him at the Ritz in Brixton. Then we hung out. And then I was like, I found my calling.
Usher got you into journalism.
This is me. Yeah. R&B hip-hop. So, and then I started getting like VIP to all the parties.
Oh my God. Well, and you probably were still like 19, 20.
I know, yeah. 16,
17.
Oh my God. So you too, you're probably at the same parties.
Well, I was just thinking, did I do that promo Usher tour? But I was
I'm older than you.
Yeah, a little bit older.
I think you
I would have just
I remember when I started seeing you on TV because there hadn't really been like black girls, women of color on TV in that space. It was June.
I mean, we're talking about June Sarpong.
Emma was obsessed with you.
Oh, Emma! Yeah, I used to watch in the T4 day.
That's so nice.
No, that's really nice because it is a connector. And it was weird getting well known, but when young black girls would go, I really love you. Wow, it's amazing. See, I was like 17. I was like, God, I guess that is quite a thing. I never had anyone. So it's a privilege to have that in my history for sure. I wanted to ask about your career in TV, Afua. How did you suddenly, because Sky News is where you first started being on screen.
The Guardian was advertising for a legal correspondent. And I was like, always been a Guardian reader. Our grandfather read The Guardian every day of his life with that kind of family. And I was like, that's kind of my dream job. But it said they wanted someone with 15 years newsroom experience, like a senior role. I was so embarrassed that I was applying, I didn't tell anyone. So I was like, this is literally ludicrous. And I thought it was insane. But I went in for the interview, and then just being in the Guardian newsroom, I was like, oh yeah, this is, these are my people. Mm-hmm. So then I was like, I am gonna get this job. I just started writing stories and sending them in. I was like mining all my friends at the bar for stories, things that hadn't been reported, and just like bombarding them with all these stories until they gave me a job.
Give me the juice.
That's quite good. That's a good scatter vomit.
You know that thing they say that like men will apply for a job if they meet like 5% of the criteria, right, and women only if they meet 95%. I was definitely moving like a dude. I was like, I have none of the requirements, but I'm a lawyer. Like, I know how the
You have the requirements. You're a lawyer, you're personable.
I had the requirements I thought they needed, not the ones they
needed. And you clearly were right.
I was right. It was a great job for me. So that's how I became a journalist. From there, I became the West Africa correspondent. So when my daughter was born, me and her and my partner, her dad, moved to Ghana. And
we all thought she was crazy.
Oh my God, so you went back to Ghana
And started on the Guardian's first ever West Africa bureau. Yeah, it kind of went a bit south when I ended up covering a lot of wars, which wasn't what I planned.
Right.
Because my whole thing was, it was so personal. My whole life, Africa's been covered so badly by the British media, and it's affected me, but it's made me embarrassed for my own African heritage. Right. You know, in the 80s, it was like embarrassing to be African.
Of course, everyone pretended to be Jamaican.
I used to lie and say I was Jamaican, and my mum overheard me doing that, and that was the first time she took us to Ghana. Wow. She's like, okay, we have a problem here. Not that there's anything wrong with being Jamaican, obviously. No, but it's just
denying yourself.
It was cool to be Jamaican in the 80s,
yeah,
and it was embarrassing to be African, and that is 100% a reflection of the racism in the British media. Yeah. And so when I had the opportunity to become West Africa correspondent, I was like, it was very restorative. I was like, this is my chance to do what I needed growing up, to actually read nuanced stories about African culture and economic growth and innovation. So I pitched it to The Guardian, like, I'm going to cover West Africa in a way that's never been done before. And they loved it. And they sent me there. I got the job. And then I got there and like a major war broke out three weeks later in which British and French and American troops were committed. And you know how the media works? Like, that was the only story in town.
Yeah.
I was still trying to pitch my stories about food and tech. Yeah, and exactly. And they're like, you want to go back to the front, please?
Right.
So and I was still breastfeeding. Like, it was not the plan at all. So that was really hard. It stretched me professionally. And I still think I covered the war in like a more nuanced way than would have been done, because wars in Africa have always been presented as like Africans just love killing each other. It's always because of how foreign powers are manipulating the African
continent. Yeah, and they're all out of control and they just,
and they all have their roots in colonialism and like the ways in which the continent's being exploited by different groups. So at least I was able to do that differently. And I still did get to do my stories about food and tech, but it was hard, you know, like wearing a flak jacket and a helmet when I was like, every time I interviewed like a refugee with a baby, my boobs would start like leaking underneath my flak jacket. It was so hard.
Wow, what a place to be at that time in your life.
It was hard.
But then when you see something like the BBC series, Africa Rising, I didn't get to watch it when it came out.
God,
I really wanted to, and we just watched it. So brilliant, so beautifully made. Who directed it?
The cinematography.
Yeah, stunning.
Thank you. We had a different director for every episode. Amazing directors, yeah.
Particularly love Nigeria.
Thank you. Yeah,
Nigeria's incredible.
And that director is Jason Ferguson. He's amazing.
He's incredible.
Yeah.
Jason.
Yeah, Jason.
We really responded to the depth of field in it, like the colour, but the personalities, like that brilliant chef. She called Oyehi.
Oyehi
in Nigeria. I was like, I have to go.
Oh my God. I have to say, Nigeria was so fun to film. I've always loved Nigeria. I find it so like spiritually enriching to be in Nigeria. As a Ghanaian, I'll get cancelled for saying this, but it is like a really special place.
I was like, don't say it.
There is a level of kind of chaos, but it was really interesting in Nigeria actually, because for each episode, we try and have like a central question, like a thesis. And in Nigeria, our question was, what is Nigeria's secret sauce? Because wherever you're from, like no one can deny that Nigerians are hugely overrepresented in art, music, in science, like whatever Nigerians do, they seem to like blow it out of the water.
Yeah.
So in Nigeria, we were like, what is it about this country. Like, why do Nigerians excel in every field they go into? And every single person we interviewed, without exception, said, because life in Nigeria is so hard, it takes so much resilience and vision and dedication to get through a day.
Wow.
That if you apply those same qualities to your art, you're gonna be the best.
Because
you're gonna be the
best. Got that kind of drive.
And I just thought that was real, because with Africa Rising, in a way, this was my chance to do what I didn't fully get to do as the West Africa correspondent for The Guardian.
Right, that's what I was gonna say. It's like, and then you got your time.
It was really like to sit in the joy and the genius of African cultures and show it visually. Like, it was such an amazing thing to be able to do. But I want to ask, because I absolutely loved you guys' series on the Caribbean.
Oh, thank you.
I loved it. And it actually was part of the inspiration for Africa Rising, because I felt like you guys gave yourselves permission to just celebrate while also being honest about some of the things that were hard and the struggles. But it was just so joyful and beautiful. And I don't think I'd ever seen anything like that, where you were really honest about your personal connection, but you were really curious about the contemporary situation and the history. It was just gorgeous. And I just found it so lovely and interesting.
I'm
and I
so
learned
pleased.
A lot about you both.
I'm so pleased.
It's important, I think, to tell stories from all over the world from the inside out, rather than from the outside in, because they're all often told through the view of the outsider going, look what these people do.
Exactly.
Aren't they interesting? Isn't it fascinating? Look what they. So to allow Caribbean voices to have our own voice in those films was hugely important to us. It was like we wanted people to tell us their own stories.
And I don't think people
voices.
Realize how difficult it is to make that kind of content for British
right.
TV. You have to be willing
the process
to put yourself on the line.
It's
like a hill you have to die on. Like my series, I had to fight every stage for it to not start regressing to those colonial, like, what about corruption? Let's show, you know. And it's like,
Afua, thank you for saying that, because that process for us with the Caribbean as well, very difficult, very, very much a fight.
You couldn't see it, but I just know, because I know what it's like to make. I just knew you would have had to fight to protect the integrity of what you made.
Every single little part.
And it's so unfair that you have to pay a personal price just to be able to make a program that is really successful and people want to watch.
Right. But do you feel, because we were talking about this earlier, that because of that, because it's so hard, we almost get set, not just as people of colour or women of colour, but I think in any marginalised group, even, you know, even if it's just women, because it's tough to tell the stories, it's tough to get it made, you end up feeling almost in competition with each other.
Yeah.
You know, is there space for all of us?
I think, in a way, like, you know, I think about my career. I mean, my cousin, who I mentioned, she now works at the FT. She gave me my first break by taking me to The Voice. Mm-hmm. June Sarpong, I used to do a show on Sky News with her. She was so kind and supportive and nurturing of me.
Yes, me too.
And just gave me so many breaks. And so, you know, like, Black women have stepped up. Gillian Joseph at Sky News helped me get my first job at Sky. Everything I've done, there's been a Black woman inside rooting for me.
Yeah.
And I really carry that, and I try and pay it forward. I try to be that Black woman for younger women, for anyone coming through, but especially younger women, because I remember the difference it made to me. So I think that, you know, those individual choices of, like, being about it, supporting us, believing in us, it does make a difference.
So I heard this really brilliant interview with Cor Jefferson, the guy who directed American Fiction. To get that film made was so hard, as you can probably
imagine. I know, because I was working with him when he was trying to get it made.
And he said, which I found really interesting, that he kept meeting people or having meetings with people who were, like, really supportive of the creative, like, this is amazing, this is incredible. And then the next breath would be, I wish I worked for a company that could make this film.
Oh, my God, welcome
and
to my life.
And then it was Black women in the upper echelons who finally went, he took it, and, you know, there were different women who finally went, oh, no, and supported the project and pushed it over the line. Diversity is not just a word. It's like we need to be everywhere. You need to be right through every space. We need to be everywhere so that things can happen.
I think as well, people don't realise, like, in America, there is a Black woman at the top of almost every major network or broadcaster. Like, we don't have that here.
Wow, God, is there?
But compared to the UK, you can go into a space and meet a Black woman who is the gatekeeper, who is interested in you, who's willing to, like, take a risk. As the industry sees it as a risk, she doesn't necessarily see it as a risk. And here, if you look at who is the gatekeeper at all the biggest streamers, there are a few exceptions, like Anne Mensah at Netflix, who's Ghanaian heritage. Shout out to that. She's cool.
But, she sounds,
you know,
great.
Like, there's not, there. It's, there's still few.
So, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for coming. It's so nice to meet
so
you.
So lovely to meet you both.
I didn't know that you had a sister.
I love that you grew up together, because I have a cousin
and we're both same age, and it's just that kind of bond and that link, and I can just feel that from you too.
I really love my sister. She's like, we're quite different.
Very different. Choices.
Yes.
Well, just everything.
But we're choices. Really similar. Like we're really different, but we're
you're
really
connected
close.
And linked.
We love each other's children. Mm. We're like always there for each other.
Totally.
You can lucky. Feel that. You yeah. can feel lucky. That.
Yeah. My God, you drank that fast.
That was so good.
The cocktail went down nice. Heralding in the spring.
Cheers. Cheers, everybody.
Couldn't think of two better chicks to do it with.
I know, what a joy.
It's really yummy, that. I'm so proud of my drink today. What a pair of incredibly dynamic, brilliant, kind, warm, excellent women.
They're kind of what you hope happens.
Yes.
When children grow up, as Afua said, with privilege, you hope that what happens then is that they become the best version of themselves, and that's exactly what happened with them. Often it goes the other way. Just brilliant people to be around, just really fascinating, and lovely energy. Like they came in and I just felt at ease. I like that sister energy.
But because Afua does come across as sort of an academic to me, because I'm so not. We're both mixed race, we're both on TV, and we've done things that are similar in our work life. Only the TV stuff, can I just hasten to add.
You haven't really done any West African war coverage lately, have you?
I didn't really get through that bachelor's degree. Right. But it's interesting, all these different ways to have a career, and to be brave and to give things up and pivot and look in another direction
and
see what it gives you.
Isn't she a lesson in listening to the whisper?
Listen to the whisper.
Listen to the voice inside you that is trying to tell you you're doing the wrong thing or trying to tell you what to do next. It's not a fluke. It's your spirit trying to communicate with you. It's the universe talking to you. Listen.
Listen, but also I get that voice when I'm doing the right thing.
Yeah. It's like, yes, correct.
Why is it tingling in the... I think I'm on the right path. So, yeah, it was beautiful to see all the myriad things that Afua has done and that she continues to do and still intends to do. Like, you know, she's in LA being a professor of journalism at USC.
And making scripted television.
Yes, has her own film and TV company.
Amazing.
And just unstoppable, but just, feel, as you said, she keeps moving. She
it's
keeps
a lesson
moving.
In keep to your vision, keep to your focus, keep on keeping on.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.